The Second World War is the largest event in human history.
A 20-part series with Tom Hanks.
No part of the globe was untouched. No life unchanged.
Experience the ultimate account of World War II.
Every single person had a story. These are the stories that make us who we are.
Listen to World War II with Tom Hanks on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Deadline, where the biggest stories, the smartest journalists, and the conversations that matter come together from Odyssey news stations across the country. When news breaks, the story doesn't stop there. I'm Christy Strasser. Let's get started. Senator Lindsey Graham died suddenly Saturday evening. Graham, a Republican from South Carolina and a one-time opponent turned stalwart ally of President Trump, was a forceful advocate for an interventionist U.S. foreign policy.
ABC News political analyst Steve Roberts, who joins us from Washington. Steve, good morning. It's good to talk with you. I know you knew Lindsey Graham for many years. He seems to be a guy who was pretty good at reaching across the aisle. In fact, a lot of people seem to like him, no matter which party they're in.
He was very likable, and he was very visible, and he was very charming. It's one of the reasons why he probably is the best known U.S. senator to ordinary Americans. He was supposed to be on Meet the Press yesterday. It would have been his 64th appearance, Steve, on that prestigious NBC program. He was on Face the Nation, CBS, almost 100 times. He was so well known that Saturday Night Live lampooned him at least twice, which is, you know, you do not get to be made fun of on Saturday Night Live if you're anonymous. That was really a sign of how he had stood out from kind of the faceless crowd in the U.S. Senate. I venture to say there are very, very few senators whose death we would be talking about this morning. And it's partly because of his visibility on TV and partly because he made a decision in his career to go from being a foe of Donald Trump's to being a friend. He was highly critical of Trump early in Trump's career. He called him a xenophobic racist bigot during the campaign of 2016. But once Trump won, Graham is a very shrewd politician. And he was pretty open about it. He said, look, I want to be relevant, a word he used. I want to be influential, another word he used. He wanted to be visible. And he figured I can only do that by being a friend of Donald Trump. Trump was dominating the Republican Party. Look what's happened to people in the Republican Party who opposed Donald Trump. Senator Cassidy of Louisiana and Senator Cornyn of Texas were defeated in primaries because challengers who were supported by Trump. Graham took exactly the opposite route, and he became one of Trump's closest friends and closest allies. And yet he managed to maintain friendships and strategic alliances across the aisle. One Democrat, Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, said this morning, you know, I disagreed with Lindsey on a lot of things, but he always listened to me and he respected me. And that quality of actually listening to someone across the aisle, I got to tell you, Steve, it's very rare in today's Washington. And Lindsey Graham was one of the few who was able to maintain those kinds of relationships.
You mentioned his ability to reach across the aisle, and you mentioned Senator Dick Blumenthal of Connecticut. I mean, the two had traveled to Ukraine together, working on that. So, you know, with all the things that are partisan in Washington, Lindsey Graham seemed to find a way to work on bipartisan projects.
Fewer than he used to, you know, because Washington had changed around. When he first came to Washington, he was central to a whole series of bipartisan efforts to pass judgeship nominations, to work on immigration, to work on he was so willing to work with Democrats that he was criticized by people like Rush Limbaugh on the conservative right as being too receptive to Democrats. But, Graham, and he did become, as a friend of Trump's, in order to maintain a pipeline to Trump. One of the last conversations Lindsey Graham ever had, just hours, maybe even minutes before he died, was with Donald Trump on Saturday night. And he had a very close friendship with Trump. Trump described him as like a member of his family. But so Graham today had gotten more partisan than the Graham of 10, 15 years ago, but he still had the ability and the instinct to maintain relationships with Democrats, particularly on foreign policy, and particularly when it came to projecting America's power around the world and maintaining alliances with friendships. And this is an area where he often disagreed with Trump. He was deeply devoted to the cause of Ukraine when Trump wavered repeatedly on Ukraine. Graham was deeply devoted to maintaining the NATO alliance when Trump often was at odds with NATO allies. And the last thing Graham ever did was work on this bill with Blumenthal and Shaheen, two Democrats. And he announced it just hours before his death, a bill that would toughen the sanctions against Putin and Russia. Now, this is not necessarily something that Donald Trump is in favor of. Trump has often been far softer and far more accommodating and far weaker in opposing Putin than Lindsey Graham, who maintained a very vigorous support of Ukraine and a very vigorous opposition to Putin right down to the hours before his death.
Mark Sandolo is with us. Mark, good morning. With Lindsey Graham gone and Mitch McConnell still away, how does that change the math in the Senate, especially if big votes come up?
Steve, they had a 3-vote margin. Now they've got a 1-vote margin, Republicans, that is, until McConnell can return. And while they can fill Graham's seat pretty quickly with an appointment from the South Carolina governor, there are things right on the calendar this week. I mean, renewal of the FISA bill, the surveillance law that the government uses to spy on people. There's a huge Pentagon budget, double what it was in the past, which is a very tightly contested bill. Todd Blanche, President Trump's former attorney, who is up this week for hearings before the Judiciary Committee, and you know, Graham was on that committee. What it means is that Republicans had a small margin. Now they've literally got a 1-vote margin, which puts them in a position where any one senator can make a difference and can hold out and try to get concessions. So it changes the dynamic. And I think just as important of that, Graham was this liaison between traditional Republicans, those who always supported a strong military, anti-Russia, and institutionalists, and Donald Trump, who clearly is not an institutionalist, who shatters norms every day. And I know he told one interviewer I read this morning, he has a special skill when he goes over to talk to NATO folks, Graham does. He says, I'm bilingual. I speak European, and I also speak Trump.
You know, it's interesting if at least temporarily they only have a 1-vote majority. I mean, there are a couple of Republican senators, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska comes to mind, also Susan Collins of Maine, who are looking to be more independent these days. Could that flip a vote? Or would leadership just make sure a vote doesn't come up?
It's not as easy to do that anymore. I mean, look, the Appropriations Committee, that's where they approve all the spending bills. Republicans had a 15-14 majority on that. So even if Democrats complain, as long as Republicans stick together, they can get through whatever they want. Well, both McConnell and Graham are on that committee. That means as of this morning, as Senate comes back after a 2-week recess, Democrats actually have more members on the Appropriations Committee. They can't get anything through right now. Now, that'll change. Republicans, I mean, not only will there be a replacement for Graham, but they can certainly, Republicans can shuffle people in and out of that committee to replace whoever is not there. But, you know, it does raise the specter of, this is what happens when you've got 24 of members of Congress who are 80 years plus, half of whom, by the way, are running for re-election. Now, that didn't count Lindsey Graham. I mean, he was he had just turned 71 just last week, just days before his death. But it does raise the specter of, this is what happens when you have a bunch of old folks in Congress, is sometimes they're simply not able to vote.
Mark, only about 45 seconds left, but you knew Lindsey Graham. You interviewed him many times on the Hill. Will he be remembered as one who could reach across the aisle?
So I knew the old Lindsey Graham, and I'll tell you, there was a huge difference. When I used to hang around and interview him, it was when John McCain was running for president in 2028, and Lindsey Graham was on that Straight Talk Express, and he was an accolade of McCain's, and he was a maverick, pro-immigration reform. He was an advocate for environmental reforms because he knew that global warming was a thing. And something flipped in him when Donald Trump became president, to the point where he at one point said he can't stand the fact that the media called this guy a kook. He's not fit to run for office. How dare they say that? But people found a clip of him 1 year earlier saying about President Trump, he's a kook. He's not fit to run for office. So Lindsey Graham will go down as sort of a classic politician, not one who is known, though, for his consistency in his positions.
That's the latest on the political scene. But what about the workplace? Turns out many of us are spending too much time there. Here's WWJ in Detroit.
Hey, it's Jen Hatmaker. Here's what I've learned in midlife. Joy isn't the reward you earn after all the work is done. Joy is the work. That's what this new series on For the Love is all about. The sacred, yes. It's choosing delight, rest, and pleasure on purpose. Because saying yes to yourself, that's the thing that finally lets you fill your table with everybody else. Come find your sacred yes with me. Follow and listen to For the Love wherever you get your podcasts.
It's summertime and a lot of people are taking vacation, but it turns out a lot of people who work are not taking their vacation and PTO time. Joining me to talk about it is Leah Raphael, the branch director for Robert Half in Metro Detroit. And Leah, what did you find in a recent survey?
We found in our most recent survey that over half of workers across the country did not use all of their PTO last year. And about 60% of them said that they were stressed about the workload that they would be returning to if they did take their PTO. So we are finding that a ton of people are not using their paid time off.
But that's just crazy. I mean, you're just leaving money on the table.
Absolutely. And it's hard-earned paid time off, right? Like that is paid time off that you earned through, you know, working your job. So a lot of them, the big reasons that we found are that they're worried their workload will pile up while they're away. And they cited a lack of backup support is the reason they didn't take time off. So even though they could think about taking time off, they're stressed that while they're there, workload's piling up. It's just going to be worse when they come back. And they can't fully unplug while they're on their PTO.
Well, what can they do about it?
So from the worker side of things, there's three tips that I generally give. One is to communicate early with their manager before you take your vacation on prioritizing projects, set expectations. Make sure everyone knows what can wait until you return. The other thing is just preparing for your time away. So wrap up any urgent work, delegate what you can, leave clear notes to colleagues so they're not scrambling while you're gone. And then, of course, trust your backup and disconnect. So if your employer has a coverage plan in place, resist the urge to constantly check your emails and messages. The whole point of PTO is to recharge so you can come back more productive and engaged.
Now, if more than 54% are not using their paid time off, what is this causing?
It leads to burnout, really. And burnout can affect so many things, including productivity, engagement, overall well-being. Without time to recharge, stress just continues to build and trickles down into all of these things.
And I don't know if you talk about this in your survey or not, but what should companies be doing to, you know, get people to take their time off?
You know, what companies can do is encourage employers taking their time off, create an environment where they feel comfortable taking their time off, help their employers, you know, build a plan so that they feel, you know, comfortable with their backup plan. They can go out, recharge, and fully unplug, knowing that the team in place is covering for them.
And do companies sometimes hire extra help if, you know, they've got a lot of people taking vacation? Would that be a solution too?
Absolutely. So that is exactly where, you know, something that someone like a Robert Half, like my team, can do is, you know, we work with organizations around Metro Detroit with helping with this seasonal support is what we call it. So when people go out on PTO, we have contractors who can come in, you know, plug that skill gap, help keep things moving so that the team doesn't fall behind on deadlines and so that the team in place isn't also feeling that burnout when someone steps out to take their PTO.
All right. And then part of the problem, I guess, is that a lot of companies have been working with, you know, a reduced workload for a while anyway.
Absolutely. I mean, I was just speaking with an organization this week that was telling me for the entire year, they've been having to do more with less, right? And that really weighs down on the team. And that's where I came in and, you know, was able to support with extra hands in getting a few projects down the finish line. And it's just really important that companies look at all of the factors on where they can leverage external and internal support on these projects so that their core team does not get burnt out.
For a company, I guess, for managers, what are some signs that your employee or employees are burned out?
I mean, I think you see it in the day-to-day, right? It's their productivity may drop. Their engagement may not be as high as it typically was. You might notice that they're tired, their lack of affect. I mean, there's all these little signs that as a manager, you know to look out for with your team and to understand that it might be because of the burnout they're feeling on the team. It could be from something at home, but a lot of the times it's a mixture of everything.
And what about if you're the employee? When is it time maybe to move on to another company?
You know, that's a great question. And typically the advice I give is have the conversation with your current employer before you make any decisions. The best thing you can do is bring it to your manager, have the conversation, express exactly what you're struggling with, where the burnout's coming from, where you think you could use more support, and give them time to correct that path for you and see if they do step up and get you that extra support. If after multiple conversations it's going nowhere, then maybe it's time to start looking for the next opportunity.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Berry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.
Life can feel overwhelming, but you don't have to go through it alone. On my podcast, From the Heart with Rachel Braithen, I share openly and vulnerably about everything life brings us and what we can learn by living with our hearts a little bit more open. Every Friday, a new episode brings you a new story with topics on self-care, motherhood, healing, and more. You are enough, just the way you are. This podcast is a reminder of that. Follow and listen to From the Heart with Rachel Braithen wherever you get your podcasts.